people that are pro-iodine will say, well, everyone is iodine deficient, so why not give it to everyone? You can say the entire U.S. population has deficiency of all minerals. That doesn't mean that's the treatment for their disease, you know?
Hello and welcome to the Ultimate Health Podcast, episode 256. Jesse Chappas here with Marnie Wasserman, and we are here on a weekly basis to take your health to the next level. This week, our featured guest is Dr. Detis Karazian. He's a clinical research scientist, academic professor, and a functional medicine healthcare provider. He specializes in developing evidence-based models to treat autoimmune, neurological, and unidentified chronic diseases with non-pharmaceutical applications such as diet, nutrition, and lifestyle medicine.
We are actually recording this intro for you guys from Bali. So if you hear some background noise, we are sitting outside of our villa and there is definitely some creatures around us. So super exciting. We're having the best time on our honeymoon. And yeah, we're still getting an episode out to you guys as we do every week. And you're really in for a treat this week because Dr. Karazian is someone that we've been wanting to have on the show for a very long time. And his name has been floating around and we know that he is one of the top experts, not only in thyroid health, but also in brain health. So we have him on today and we know we're going to have him on again. And you guys have to get ready because today's episode goes really deep. He's bringing some cutting edge information that has not been shared before, definitely not on our podcast. And the research is so new and so exciting that you guys are going to hear it for the first time today. So here's some of what we talk about with Dr. Karazian. We discuss why the majority of hypothyroid patients have Hashimoto's, breaking down TH1 and TH2 and what these are, problems with conventional thyroid testing, symptoms of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, how lifestyle factors can impact Hashimoto's, new research published about cross-reacting food proteins, the benefits of hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes. So much great information. I hope you guys are ready. Here we go with Dr. Karazian.
Hello, Detis, and welcome to the podcast. How are things?
Great. Thank you for having me on.
We're so happy to have you on. And we're going to get into all things thyroid health today. And you have such a comprehensive book that is definitely something I recommend to people. It's called Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms When My Lab Tests Are Normal? So a really important book. Is this something that you've just been seeing in practice over and over again? Or what inspired you to dig into this topic so deeply?
For me, what I was doing was when I was first in practice about 20 years ago, I followed what I was taught. What I was taught was goitrogenic foods are a problem and everyone needs iodine. And that's using axillary temperature. And that's how you fix thyroids. And I was doing lab tests with everybody. And what I was seeing is I wasn't getting any changes with patients. You know, the interesting thing is when you do routine blood work on all new patients and then you follow up with them on a regular basis, you can really take out all the theories and see what's actually making a difference for the patient. I would do routine blood work on all new patients. Many of the patients I saw would have thyroid issues, and they were seeking consultation to see if they can manage their thyroid issues with diet, nutrition, lifestyle. Many of them were already hypothyroid and already on medication, but they still weren't feeling well. So when we did the typical thing and put them on tyrosine, put them on iodine, try to give them various nutrients to help their system, there would really be no difference with their outcomes. I got a bit frustrated after some time, and I started to do more research and read up on it. And I just picked up a endocrinology book, and one of the things that it said in there is that the majority of hypothyroid patients have Hashimoto's, and I started to read more into that. And the studies really show about 95% of people that have hypothyroidism have an autoimmune disease called Hashimoto's, and the way it's diagnosed is through antibodies. So then I started to run thyroid antibodies with my patients. In addition to the thyroid markers, it was very clear these patients that had hypothyroidism had an autoimmune disease called Hashimoto's because they would have positive TPO antibodies. And the one thing I learned initially was if they had thyroid antibodies, I was absolutely going to fail with them in clinical practice. And then the focus really became to really treat them as an autoimmune patient. And that's when we made some big differences. This was back in 2000. And a lot of the things that we were taught, like goitrogenic foods and iodine supplementation, these were outdated concepts and sometimes even triggering the autoimmune disease. And then I was doing that in practice for some period of time, and I started teaching. I was always teaching practitioners in the seminar circuit. And back in 2000, I was doing about 80 events a year, teaching all over the country. So I started to share what I was finding and doing that was effective with patients back in 2001, 2002. And then right around 2010, with an encouragement and help of my friend Elaine Fawcett, we put out my thyroid book. And that was really the first book that really challenged the model of how thyroid was being changed. Now, if you look at every thyroid book published the past 5 years, everyone's focusing from an autoimmune perspective and really the foundation of that first book. So that's how it all started. And I can tell you that book that we published in 2010, there's so much new information. And we're really working on a completely new thyroid book. And we've done a lot of new research and published some of these studies. So we're getting more efficient in how to treat Hashimoto's.
Good. And I hope that we are able to get into some of that new research. And I'm actually one of those Hashimoto's patients. I discovered that I had it last year, although I think I've had it for many years. And it's something that I've been digging in deep with my own health for the last year and always learning. So getting into your book has been really helpful, and I'm excited to see where this conversation goes. But I think a really important place to start is talking about why some of the measures that people are still getting from their doctor, like TSH alone, is such a model for failure.
Well, TSH levels are going to fluctuate off and on with Hashimoto's patients. So if we just discuss Hashimoto's patients, in general, thyroid stimulating hormone is released when the thyroid gland itself isn't producing enough thyroid hormones, and there's a signal to the pituitary to release more stimulating hormone, TSH. But if you look at Hashimoto's patients and you measure their TSH, say every 2 weeks for the next 2 months, it's going to be all over the place. So one reading, it could be normal. At one reading, it could be high. One reading could be low. That's a pretty routine pattern. So sometimes, you know, a patient may have all the symptoms and not get diagnosed. They're just going into the office when their TSH is within the lab reference range. And then other times, they may look like they're hypothyroid, and other times they may look like their TSH is very low. And part of the reason is because with Hashimoto's, the immune system is attacking the thyroid gland. And when it attacks the thyroid gland, it destroys thyroid tissue. And the thyroid tissue contains thyroid hormones. So when those thyroid hormones get released in the bloodstream, that normalizes TSH. And then at times, they're actually not producing enough thyroid hormones, and there hasn't been an aggressive attack against the tissue, so there isn't enough thyroid hormones in the bloodstream, and that makes TSH go up. So with TSH, it really goes all over the place with Hashimoto's. At some point, if you're on thyroid replacement, you can keep your TSH on the lower end, but that TSH is now skewed by the fact that the person's on replacement. It's not skewed, it's just the fact that it's the TSH reading with the understanding that they're on replacement. So TSH is a useful marker. You just have to be careful with interpreting it with what's actually going on with the patient.
Well, let's get into some of these other markers that you can test for, things that you're testing for with patients to give a more comprehensive picture of what's happening.
So, you know, for me, once I know a patient's hypothyroid and we have the antibodies, the rest of it is now we have to get to work. There's no point to constantly check antibodies. There's no point to constantly check TSH. Antibodies fluctuate all over the place. Sometimes antibodies look normal or look suppressed because the total white blood cells have dropped. So I think when people are just looking at antibodies, they have to look at it in combination with the total immune panel where they look at T cells and B cells and really see what's going on with their cluster differential proteins and their overall immune system health. Just randomly running antibodies and then trying one protocol and then another and seeing if there's any kind of change is really inefficient. Now, you can do comprehensive immune profiles and look at different types of markers. Those tend to be expensive. But at the end of the day, once you know a patient has Hashimoto's, there's a lot of work to do. So for me, once I know that they've been diagnosed, it's really important for them to be on thyroid hormone replacement. It's just one of the factors you want to avoid. The thyroid replacement doesn't stop the autoimmune disease. So the thyroid replacement is there just to make sure that the immune system modulates okay. You can't really fix a leaky gut if someone's thyroid hormone deficient. You really can't calm down T cells if there's thyroid hormone deficiency. So once they have been diagnosed and are on some type of replacement that works for them, then the bottom line is to really go after the autoimmune disease. So for me in my practice, I have different stages of what I do. And the first stage of what I do with Hashimoto's patients is to kind of define what their Hashimoto's is. And the first place to start is, where's the rest of the autoimmunity? So the labs I usually run after I know they have Hashimoto's isn't constantly running TSH and TPO. It's really to figure out what the rest of the autoimmunity is and how to modulate their autoimmune response.
So let's talk about this test. What is the test specifically, and what different antibodies is it testing for?
There's a couple of concepts that are really important to understand. One concept is that Hashimoto's, most of the research is showing right now that between 25% to one-third, and this is in conservative scientific journals, they're showing that they have autoimmunity in other areas. So the most common autoimmune sites for people that have Hashimoto's is transglutaminase 2, which is the celiac disease autoimmunity. Some people have transglutaminase 6, which is a gluten response to the brain and not so much intestinal. Those are very common with Hashimoto's patients. Many Hashimoto's patients also have antibodies to their cerebellum, to different areas of the neurological tissues. It could really be anywhere. So the panel I run in my practice is Cyrex, array number 5. It checks for 24 tissue antibodies. Now, the other thing that's important to understand is most people that have Hashimoto's have to be really concerned about cerebellum ataxia and cerebellum degeneration. Thyroid antibodies can cross-react with other tissues. So when you make antibodies against the, when you make thyroid antibodies, if you have Hashimoto's, those antibodies bind to the thyroid tissue, but research has also shown that these antibodies bind to Purkinje cells in the cerebellum. So when the antibodies bind to tissue, that leads to destruction. So the antibodies you make against your thyroid not only attach to your thyroid for your immune system to destroy that tissue, but they also attach to the cerebellum. One of the key things to always do in a workup with Hashimoto's patients is not only to see where the rest of the autoimmunity was with antibody markers, but also to see if they have any cerebellar ataxia signs. When the cerebellum gets destroyed, people develop what's called ataxia, and they have balance problems. If they close their eyes, they can't walk in a straight line. If it gets really progressed, they start to have termination, what are called termination tremors. When they reach out for something, their hand shakes a little bit. And that's an early sign of a neurodegenerative process that's happening from the thyroid autoimmunity. So the first thing to really understand also is that thyroid autoimmunity isn't just against the thyroid gland. It's against the thyroid gland and the cerebellum. And that's really what promoted me to write my second book. Is working with a lot of thyroid patients, I realized so many of them had brain impairments. One of the reasons they have brain impairments, there's multiple reasons, is really because of these antibodies for the thyroid gland also bind to the cerebellum. They call this thyroid encephalopathy or thyroid Hashimoto's encephalopathy, but it's very, very common.
So basically, if somebody has these antibodies for the thyroid, it's only a matter of time before they start affecting the cerebellum as well?
Yeah, for the most part, there's a degree of that, but we have to realize that those antibodies can't get to the cerebellum unless the blood-brain barrier breaks down. So if you have high levels of antibodies in your blood, and you can measure it with lab tests, if you had your antibodies checked in Hashimoto's, if they're high, then those antibodies are going to easily bind to your thyroid tissue, and they may bind to your cerebellum, but they have to get through the blood-brain barrier. But a lot of research is showing that when you have breach of your intestinal barrier, you get breach of your blood-brain barrier. So we know when zonulin levels, which is a protein marker, opens up the tight junctions of the intestines during inflammatory responses or gluten responses or those types of things, they also open up the blood-brain barrier. And just this year, we did a study and we published zonulin levels and we did some correlations with blood-brain barrier proteins. And we found a high degree of correlation with people that have leaky gut have markers for leaky blood-brain barriers. So if you have Hashimoto's, you have these antibodies binding to the thyroid gland, and then that leads to continuous thyroid gland destruction. But if your blood barrier gets breached, then those antibodies can also bind to cerebellum target proteins, and then you start to have a neuroinflammatory response against the part of the brain called the cerebellum. And if your blood brain barrier heals, then you can decrease the antibody exposure to the cerebellum. That's an ideal outcome.
Can you also explain how someone finds out if they are Th1 or Th2 dominant? This is something totally new to me that I was reading about in the book, and I think it's really important information.
Yeah, and in the book I was trying to simplify some concepts, but there's actually Th1, Th2, Th3, Th7, Th22, Th9.
Things have evolved in 8 years.
Yeah, but also when you write a book, you can't write everything. But the Th1 and Th2 is a concept where when you look at a comprehensive immune profile, and these are not your typical complete blood counts. So when you look at a profile where you're measuring different cytokines, you can actually start to see if there's a dominance of one side or another. The best way to do it is what's called a cytokine stimulated test, where they take the patient's T cells and they expose them to an antigen in a dish, and they see what kind of cytokines are released when those cells are exposed to an antigen, and they can see if the immune system is primed for a Th1 or Th2 response. But typically, in a healthy immune response, we have a Th1 response, which is our T cells, and a Th2 response, which is our B cells. And when we fight an infection, we initially have our Th1 response attack the antigen like a virus or a bacteria, and then our Th2 response makes antibodies, and that's the way things work. When people have autoimmune disease, what they found is many autoimmune disease people have an over-exaggeration of the Th1 side, the T-cell side, or the B-cell response side. And it's not the amount of T-cells or B-cells they have, it's how their T-cells and B-cells respond. And there's also nutritional supplements that actually activate T-cells and natural killer cells, and those are things like echinacea and maitake mushrooms. And there's things that really impact the B-cells, which are things like akashi or different types of anti-flavonoids. Those things tend to have like pine bark extract. Those things have to impact the Th2 site. So what we would see is when I was doing comprehensive immune panels that some of these patients would come and say, what really made me flare up recently is I tried some echinacea. I haven't been the same for the past 6 weeks. And I just had every time I get exposed to it, I really have problems. Sometimes I actually get exposed to it with herbal tea or things like that. And that is one type of Hashimoto's expressions. Other types, you see the opposite. You see some of them come in and say, the only way I can keep my swelling and inflammation and fatigue down is if I take some echinacea, for example, which is a Th1 stimulator. So we realized really early on, and this is almost 20 years ago, that some patients respond differently to different immune stimulating herbs. And some can exaggerate their immune response and some can suppress it. So in my book, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms? I list all the TH1 and TH2 botanicals and herbs that we know. We ask patients to sometimes kind of see where they are. It's hard to do the comprehensive immune panel testing on your own, but you can get a good clue of if you had adverse reactions to one side of those stimulants, TH1 or TH2 side, what things can help you or what things you can avoid.
Tatis, what's happening in the conventional medical system when it comes to Hashimoto's? Are conventional docs typically testing for these antibodies, or how are they finding out people have Hashimoto's?
So in the conventional system, they really don't test for it. And part of it is just based on the insurance model. You know, when you go in and you have symptoms of hypothyroidism and you have hair thinning and maybe fatigue and exhaustion and so forth, your doctor may run a TSH test to screen if you have hypothyroidism. And then if you have hypothyroidism, the diagnosis is done. You have high TSH, you get placed on replacement. And that's it. That's the basic model. But the people who establish the guidelines for hypothyroidism management also require that each patient that has Hashimoto's get tested every year to see if they need to increase their dosage. And the reason they do that is because they know that the mechanism for hypothyroidism is, for the most part, Hashimoto's, the solid immune response against the gland. And each year, you're going to lose more of your thyroid gland from the autoimmune response. So they need to be checked to see if they need to have their dose increased. But in reality, the marker that you would check would be TPO antibodies. Now, insurance companies don't pay for it on a routine basis when someone's hypothyroid or low thyroid function because they go, it's not going to change treatment. Whether your antibody is positive or negative, in a conventional model, the only treatment is thyroid replacement. So you're going to get checked every year. And there's no point to spend that extra money. I mean, thyroid antibodies usually get billed to insurance companies about $200 to $300 each. So if you check TPO and thyroid globulin, that's an extra $400 to $600 of testing that they consider not necessary because it doesn't change your treatment. Now, if you are the patient, it's good to know if you have an autoimmune disease. And most people that have hypothyroidism don't really know that they actually have an autoimmune disease, and they don't know that they have maybe high levels of antibodies, and that these antibodies can not only attach to the thyroid but to their brain, and also that if they have one autoimmune disease, it's likely they have others, the most common one being a celiac disease autoimmune response. So the conventional model is really following what the insurance guidelines are, which is diagnose hypothyroidism with high TSH, put a patient on replacement, and monitor them every year if they need more. And that's where it's always been, and that's where it's staying. There's no doubt that Hashimoto's and autoimmunity is the underlying mechanism, but there's no real treatment in autoimmune disease model, conventional models for Hashimoto's. The autoimmune treatment models are really for more progressed inflammatory autoimmune disease like RA or MS. That's when they would use steroids and different immune modulators to impact it, which are very, very expensive. They call them biologics. So for Hashimoto's patients, nothing's really changed. If you're in the conventional model, even if you go to the top endocrinology center in the world, you're basically going to get diagnosed hypothyroid and be on replacement without any further testing of autoimmunity.
Now we're going to take a quick break from our chat with Tatis to give a shout out to our show partner, 4Sigmatic.
One of my favorite products from 4Sigmatic is the Cordyceps medicinal mushroom, and this is the one in the red box. And Cordyceps is known for being really good for energy and stamina or endurance. So if you're someone who likes to move, you like to run, you like to work out, get your hands on Cordyceps. And there's so many different ways that you can consume these mushrooms, and I want to give you guys a few different tips so you understand how to use them. So one way is just pouring it into a cup of hot water, stirring it up. They are ready to go. That's the beauty of these sachets. You can also enhance the mushrooms with a little bit of nut milk or some natural sweetener. You can also blend in some coconut oil or ghee or some kind of nut creamer if you want for some texture. You can add it to your favorite coffee or tea, or you can drink it in the mornings or early afternoons before workout, and that is specific for Cordyceps. So if you don't have Cordyceps part of your collection, add it to the mix today.
As a listener of our show, you get 10% off all your 4Sigmatic purchases. To take advantage, super easy to do, just go to ultimatehealthpodcast.com/4Sigmatic. Again, that URL is ultimatehealthpodcast.com/4Sigmatic. Also, if you bundle that order together, spend $100 or more, you get free shipping. These products are incredible. Go and load up on Cordyceps today.
And now a shout out to our other show partner, Sun Warrior. A very critical part to your day, guys, is hydrating. It's so important to get liquid in as soon as you wake up. And it's about what you add to your morning liquid. And something that I like to add to my morning liquid is Super Greens. The Ormus Super Greens is such a great way to hydrate, alkalize, detoxify first thing in the morning. Put a scoop of that right into your water and you're ready to go. And you can also sip on it throughout the day to make sure that you are hydrated and staying energized. So if you haven't tried the Ormus Super Greens yet, get your hands on it, add it to your cart. You are going to love it. I promise you, it's really delicious.
Supercharge that morning drink with Ormus Super Greens. And as a listener of our show, you get 10% off all your Sun Warrior purchases. To take advantage, go to ultimatehealthpodcast.com/SW. Again, that's ultimatehealthpodcast.com/SW. Listeners in the US and Canada, you can bundle your order together, spend $100 or more, and you get free shipping. Go and load up on Orma Super Greens right now. And now back to our chat with Tatis.
So let's get into what someone would be looking for to even find out if they have Hashimoto's. They haven't had any blood work yet. They're just kind of feeling like something's off. What are they looking for in terms of symptoms, or where would they want to start?
If you have a chronic illness and you just have a list of multiple symptoms and no one's able to really figure out what's going on, Hashimoto's is on top of the list to rule out. Because with Hashimoto's, it's not just a disease against the thyroid gland. It's an autoimmune response. People that have Hashimoto's have leaky guts or intestinal permeabilities. They develop multiple food sensitivities. They get fatigued. They get exhausted. They get brain fog. They get inability to recover from workouts. Their metabolism changes. Half of Hashimoto's patients are normal weight. Not all of them are overweight. Basically, fatigue, exhaustion, multiple food sensitivities, those are all clues that you may have Hashimoto's. And they're very general because thyroid hormones impact all the receptors in our body. Every receptor, every tissue in our body has receptors for thyroid hormones. So when your immune system destroys your thyroid gland and you're producing less thyroid hormones, you can have a whole list of diverse symptoms. Everything from constipation to slow motility to migraines to general fatigue.
So say somebody comes to see you and they're diagnosed with Hashimoto's. What do the first steps look like? What are you going to do with this patient?
My first question is, where's the rest of it? And how long do they take to get diagnosed? So thyroid hormones are important for bone density, for gallbladder function, for intestinal motility, for healthy neuron synapses, for healthy barrier function, for healthy immune function. So if someone's had symptoms for 20 years and they finally got diagnosed, you know that they may have gallstones, you may know that they may have significant osteoporosis, you suspect that they have chronic inflammatory conditions, and that's kind of the first thing I like to do is just kind of see where's the rest of it. Because you don't want to just fixate on the thyroid gland, you want to really look at the whole patient. Then the next thing is to really consider the fact that these antibodies that were high, did they cross-react with other tissues? The one we know about so far is cerebellum. We did some research and we found some other target proteins that thyroid antibodies bind to on the brain. We haven't published those yet, but we hope to do it soon. But the point is that these antibodies can also impact the brain. So the patient's brain health becomes really important. We want to look for signs of neurodegeneration and so forth. And then the next question is, where's the rest of the autoimmunity? So then we do a CyrX-ray 5, see where the rest of the antibodies are. And then a patient may have antibodies to things like intrinsic factor, and that's the reason why they're anemic. They may have antibodies to their adrenal glands. Maybe that's why they have such low blood pressure and so forth. So we want to kind of get a big picture of where the rest of the autoimmunity is. And in my practice, I would say about 70% of my patients that have Hashimoto's, once we check for other antibodies, they have antibodies to other tissues. Let's say we have a patient who comes with Hashimoto's and they have brain fog, exhaustion, fatigue, they can't handle any brain stimulation, and they have gastric ulcers no one can help them with and they haven't responded to therapy. And then you run their lab work and then you see they have antibodies to their myelin sheaths in their nervous system. You see they have antibodies to their parietal cells. That's why they have this chronic gastric ulcer. They have antibodies to their cartilage and joint proteins, so they have some early RA, and now you go, well, all these symptoms that are so diverse and so many symptoms are really underlying causes one thing, which is autoimmunity. Then the goal is to modulate their autoimmune response.
So let's just keep going here. How do we begin to modulate that immune response? What do the first couple steps look like?
Well, we always start with lifestyle. Supplements are always last. So when we look at the lifestyle factors that trigger autoimmunity and how to modulate it, there's two key sides. There's what's called the TH3 side, and there's the TH17 side. So TH3 are where your regulatory T cells come in, and the more active your regulatory T cells are, the less expressive the autoimmune disease becomes. So you want really high regulatory T cell activity, which is what they call TH3 cell activity. And then TH17 is really the fuel to the fire of autoimmune disease, and you want to try to dampen those things. We start with just their personal relationships and have them really reflect on their work environment, their relationships at home with friends. So if you have love, appreciation, and you have people you can talk to on a regular basis in some kind of social network, you have higher TH3 function. And if you fight with your spouse, a recent study just came out showing you can get leaky gut if you fight with your spouse regularly. If you hate your work environment, you hate the people around you, you can activate the TH17 side. When I work with Hashimoto's patients and when I see them, a lot of them come to my office and they're thinking, well, what supplements do I need to take? I'm like, we're not even at supplements yet. We got to start with the basics. So some people have to change relationships. Some people have to change their work environments from a lifestyle perspective. Another major one is sleep. You have to sleep if you have Hashimoto's. If you're not putting yourself in an environment to get proper sleep, it's really hard to calm down the autoimmune response. Exercise is another key thing. If you overtrain, you increase your Th17 side. And if you exercise and get some kind of opioid response where you feel good after your exercise, that stimulates the Th3 protective side. So we kind of go through a list of things related to lifestyle first when we see Hashimoto's patients. And then we go and look at diet, dietary things that trigger Hashimoto's. And then from a dietary perspective, we have gluten as being one of the most common triggers for Hashimoto's. There's some molecular mimicry or cross-reactivity with gluten and thyroid tissue. So I mean, the antibodies against gluten can also bind to thyroid tissue. And many people that have Hashimoto's have an HLA-DQ2 or HLA-DQ1 or HLA-DQ8, which makes them susceptible to gluten sensitivity or celiac disease. Then we look at proteins that are also similar to gluten, like other grains. So usually like a paleo autoimmune diet becomes useful. The past few years, we did some research and we just published one of these papers in the Journal of Thyroid Research that was done at Harvard Medical School. We identified molecular mimicry and cross-reactivity. We screened 200 foods. So we found a list of food proteins that are actually on the autoimmune paleo diet that if you make antibodies against, that they can cross-react. So after we look with diet, nutrition, and lifestyle, we start with gluten, dairy-free diet, and then we go further by checking for molecular mimicry and cross-reactivity with other food proteins. And then we go into antigens. There's certain pathogens and infections that can have cross-reactivity with thyroid glands. So let me explain cross-reactivity. When you make antibodies against a protein, sometimes if other proteins in the body have similar structure, those antibodies can also bind to them. That's molecular mimicry cross-reactivity. So food proteins can cross-react with the thyroid, which we screen for. And then antibodies to pathogens like H. pylori can trigger Hashimoto's. So we look for infections that can cross-react with the thyroid. There's a whole list of them. H. pylori being the most common, hepatitis C being the second most common. And then once we go through those, we look through chemicals. Many chemicals impact thyroid function, like BPA or fire retardants. We try to see if those are at high levels in the body or if the patient is making antibodies against those. So at the end of the day, it's a diet, nutrition, lifestyle, infection, and chemical workup. And then as you find each one of those things, you take the layer off, and every patient is uniquely different.
So I really want to go back to the AIP, and I think this is really important because we've talked about AIP a few times on the podcast, but this is new information that you're bringing forth of how someone with Hashimoto's may have to modify the AIP accordingly depending on their unique circumstance. I know you just brushed across it, but if we can just expand on that and how someone might want to potentially approach this, or would they need certain testing in order to know which foods they're reacting with within the AIP protocol?
When we look at Hashimoto's, the first trend was you have to get off goitrogen foods, right? And that was basically disproven. Goitrogens.
Why don't we explain what goitrogens are for our audience?
Sure. So goitrogens are compounds that can compete with iodine uptake for the thyroid gland. And there are, without question, environmental goitrogens, like different chemicals, and there's definitely medications that act like goitrogens. But for a while, they suspected certain foods, like broccoli or other types of foods, can act like a goitrogen, and those have all been disproven. So that was the first big wake up in Hashimoto's, was maybe some goitrogens are a dietary concern. And then the second big thing that came out was, well, gluten sensitivity. Now we're going back 20 years. And then the big thing was gluten is associated with triggering Hashimoto's and hypothyroidism. And then not everyone, but a small group of people really up to date with the research were getting their Hashimoto's patients off gluten. And then it became, gluten has similar properties and molecular mimicry to things like milk and other grains. And that's when the autoimmune paleo diet became more popular. And if you don't know which diet to follow and you're just kind of stuck and don't have any help, the autoimmune paleo diet is probably the best one to follow if you have Hashimoto's. But for me, when I'm working with my patients with Hashimoto's, most of the patients I see have already seen multiple healthcare professionals, and they already have done great work, and they've already made some significant dietary changes. So what I would see in my practice all the time is I see patients come in, and they're already on the autoimmune paleo diet, and they're completely flared up. And they've already been gluten-free, dairy-free, and they're off grains, and they're following the autoimmune paleo diet, but they can't calm down their autoimmune response. And when you check them for example, a food sensitivity profile where you're looking at immunoglobulins or antibody reactions to food proteins, what actually shows up with most Hashimoto's patients is that they react to most proteins. They have what they call loss of tolerance. So when you start to react to every single food protein, that's called loss of tolerance. And I guarantee you, if you take 100 Hashimoto's patients and do food sensitivity profiles with them, you would have the majority of them show up with reactive to most foods you test. And then the question becomes, do you get them off every single food protein? If you test for 200 foods and they show up for 100 of them that they're reacting to, you can't remove everything. And then if you do, the foods that they're eating on their new diet is going to be things that they make antibodies for within a very short time. And really the fundamental thing is that they have what's called loss of tolerance. And I made a whole audio notes package to teach people about loss of tolerance at Dr. King News if people want to go into the detailed approach how we do it. So our focus was to get their tolerance back, but they came in a position going, which food proteins really make a difference? We did a laboratory study with the help of Dr. Vijdani, who's a immunologist. We did the study. We published it in the Journal of Thyroid Research. It was done out of Harvard Medical School and Loma Linda School of Medicine, Department of Preventive Medicine and Immunosciences. And we took 200 food proteins and we purified them. And then what we did is we had monoclonal and polyclonal antibodies, which are very pure antibodies. To make it very simple, we took pure protein with no other contaminants and we took pure antibodies. And we wanted to see which ones have molecular mimicry or cross-reacts. We found a list of food proteins that can cross-react with a thyroid gland. And the next step of this, and this is also why I'm revising and writing a new thyroid book, is really to share with people this type of research, because I needed to figure out what to do with my patients that are already off every food. And we found that there's a list of really common foods that have molecular mimicry with the thyroid gland. And so we did publish that in the Journal of Thyroid Research. It's available online. If you go to PubMed, National Library of Medicine, and type in my name, you'll see the paper. But now what I do is I have patients that come in and we'll check them for antibodies and see if they have any of those cross-reactive antibodies. If you guys are looking for the paper online, it's called Immunological Reactivity Using Monoclonal and Polyclonal Antibodies of Autoimmune Target Sites with Dietary Proteins. It's a long name, but we're hoping at Dr. King News to make a summary of the results that are easy to understand. It's very technical if you read it, but that was part of the goal. So for me, I had to figure out which food proteins cross-react with the thyroid because I was dealing with a different level of thyroid patients. I was dealing with thyroid patients that had already been on the autoimmune paleo diet and already started taking all these things to help fix their leaky gut. And the question was, well, why can't we calm it down? What's the missing component? And cross-reactive food proteins is one of the major ones.
And I can totally relate to that. I have definitely gone through my own food journey over the last year by going onto the AIP, going off of it, finding the reintroductions okay, that I didn't react to any specific food. But overall, I'm feeling better, but I know that there's still some triggers, and I don't know whether now that they are food related or not. So I can definitely see the relevance of looking into this further for myself and definitely for the people that I'm interacting with. So I'm excited that you're getting this research out there. So for people listening, other than what you're publishing, there's no other resource for this information available right now.
Well, cross-reactivity of the thyroid gland, there's lots of research published in the scientific literature, mostly with infections. But what we found was that there was a void between foods and cross-reactivity. And you understand, a study like this is exhaustive, it's very expensive, and no one's really interested to fund it. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
So it was an effort with our own resources and our own time and energy. It was done at the number one medical university in the world, Harvard Medical School, with the researcher and the teams there. So it's an extensive area of study. But like, I'll give you an example. One of the things we found was proteins, for example, in almond cross-react with the thyroid gland, potentially. We found most of the foods that contain iodine, many of the fishes, can cross-react with the thyroid gland. Tuna has severe cross-reactivity with the thyroid gland. So if you make antibodies against tuna, that's a major problem. We also found a protein that's found commonly in avocados and latex gloves, latex haven protein cross-react. So you could have someone prepare your food with latex gloves and you get some of those proteins from the latex gloves on your salad as they're prepping your salad. And if you have antibodies against latex haven protein, you can absolutely flare up your thyroid gland. We found gluten-free soy sauce cross-reacts with the thyroid gland. So,
well, thank you for doing this work. This is such breakthrough science, and it's going to help so many people, and I'm excited to get my hands on the paper. We're definitely going to link that up in the show notes. And since you brought up iodine a couple of times, I think we should definitely unravel this because there is still a lot of controversy around this, and you talked about how there is a lot of old information on it, but there are still people taking supplements and believe that it's going to help them. So let's have you just unravel this.
I've been talking about the concerns with iodine for Hashimoto's for a long period of time. And over the past 20 years, I started talking about this back in 2002 because of what's been published in the literature. And in the literature, they do these studies where they find high rates of hypothyroidism in areas where there's iodine deficiencies. For example, this are like studies with 15,000 people, 10,000 subjects, and they give them iodine prophylactically to help with their hypothyroidism or their goiter. And what they see is that their iodine deficiencies go away, but there's an explosion of Hashimoto's and new cases being diagnosed and those that have already had it getting worse. And this has been done repeatedly in multiple scientific journals from multiple regions of the world, from different research groups, to the point where if you look at the evidence, it's pretty clear that this could be a major concern. Iodine activates the TPO response for Hashimoto's. It's that simple. I don't know why there's even a controversy. I mean, there's only a controversy if you completely neglect what's being published. There isn't studies that show iodine calms down Hashimoto's. There's none. There's no study published on it. There's studies where they give people iodine and they don't really see anything happen with TSH. You know, we only need a trace amount of iodine to support a thyroid gland. But foods that have, for example, molecular, like when we did a cross-reactive study, we found lots of seafoods rich in iodine and structures, molecular mimicry structures, just like T3 and T4. That you make antibodies against those food proteins, they can bind to your T3, T4 hormones and even to your thyroid gland. That's a problem. Some people have like come up with stories, well, you know, if you have selenium deficiency, then iodine's not a problem, but you supplement both together. I don't understand them. I don't understand when theory outweighs what's been published by so many studies. I mean, I don't get it. I just assume these people don't read the papers or know how to read papers, or fortunately in the world of nutrition, we're driven by theories and models and not as much with the science. And there's no question. If you look through the scientific literature, you see very little impact with iodine supplements and studies changing Hashimoto's. None of them do, and only that they flare them up. So, I mean, years ago I said, this is almost malpractice. Like, if a patient Hashimoto's and they flare it up and someone wanted to file suit, I mean, they just have to go and see what's published on the literature and you'd have no support. But I think what people don't understand, the reason that it's such a big deal is, let me give you a perspective. If you get a thyroid patient that comes in, and let's say you do a complete workup, and you see not only are they attacking their thyroid gland, but they have antibodies to 21-hydroxylase, which is a marker for adrenal autoimmunity, and they have antibodies against, let's say, neurofilament or myelin basic protein, which means when their immune system flares up, they don't only destroy their thyroid gland, but they also have destruction of their brain and their adrenal glands. When you give iodine, all of these antibodies fluctuate. It has an immune-stimulating property. Immune stimulating response. So the total T cell response goes crazy and wherever the antibodies are, it gets destroyed. So people think, well, I'm just taking iodine, you know, oh well. It's a really big deal. I mean, I've seen such devastating effects with iodine, looking at lab work and looking at antibodies with patients. Now, some people don't have any adverse reactions. The point is, like, you don't really get much benefit giving it to patients that have Hashimoto's, and you can see many of them, not all of them, but many of them have significant immune triggering responses through it. And there's been points where I know there's Dr. Bronstein and some other people that have discussed iodine. I'm up for debate.
And it's in a lot of supplements, too. Like, it's in a lot of thyroid supplements that I think people are taking right now, even before they go on to thyroid hormone medication. They're on maybe some brand name of a natural thyroid supplement with selenium and all kinds of good stuff in there. And they're thinking that that's really good, but you're saying they could be really flaring up their symptoms.
Absolutely. And one of the things I also do when I see new patients, I look at the supplements they're taking and I'm looking for things that can be triggers for their thyroid. So, like, for example, some supplements have iodine in there without the patient even knowing it. Corn fillers or gluten fillers are common with the lower quality supplements. Also, if you are one of these pro-iodine people, anytime you want to have an academic debate, I'm on board. Let's do it. Because you cannot win that argument. You can only win that argument with, oh, well, I see patients taking iodine and they do better. Like, that's anecdotal. That doesn't matter. I mean, we all have reported adverse reactions all over the country when you talk to doctors. There was one study that was done in a journal where they actually did iodine restriction, and they found that there was 80% of the patients had an improvement in their hypothyroid Hashimoto's response after a few weeks. There's stuff we have to learn about it, but right now, I just don't see the logic of giving someone Hashimoto's iodine. The reason they have Hashimoto's isn't because they're iodine deficient. The reason they have Hashimoto's is because their immune system is destroying their thyroid gland. They've lost their self-tolerance. It's an autoimmune response model. It's not a nutrient deficiency model.
Now we're going to take another quick break from our chat with Tatis to give a shout out to our show partner, Thrive Market.
If you live in the USA and you have a computer in front of you, get online and start shopping at Thrive Market right now. And the beautiful thing about Thrive Market is that you can search by any category. You can search by paleo, vegan, gluten-free, and even grain-free. And that is a category that Jesse and I like to shop under because you can find so many alternatives to things that you would commonly eat that have grains in it. Everything from chips to granola to pasta to cracker alternatives, it's all there. And you can load them all in your cart, and you're getting all of these products at 20 to 50% off of regular retail value. In addition, you're getting 25% off your order, plus free shipping, plus a 30-day free trial.
To take advantage of your incredible listener discount, all you need to do is go to ultimatehealthpodcast.com/thrivemarket. Again, that URL is ultimatehealthpodcast.com/thrivemarket. Go and take advantage today. And now back to our chat with Tatis. And is there ever concern over time becoming iodine deficient if you have Hashimoto's and you're avoiding it at all costs?
This is the debate. So the people that are pro-iodine will say, well, everyone is iodine deficient, so why not give it to everyone? You can say the entire U.S. population has deficiency of all minerals. That doesn't mean that's the treatment for their disease, you know? If the thyroid gland has an iodine trap, you don't need that much iodine to produce thyroid hormones. So even trace amounts of iodine that people get can, just from regular food, can give what the thyroid gland needs. Like, there's this misconcept, this loss of connection with nutritional physiology, what the thyroid gland needs, that the more iodine you take, the better it is for your thyroid gland. The thyroid gland, if you do a biopsy of tissue, even with Hashimoto's people, is loaded with iodine. It has plenty of iodine in there to make thyroid hormones. And they've actually done research where they've done complete iodine restriction on animals, and even in some human dietary studies, that there's no change in producing thyroid hormones when people stop consuming iodine for many, many years. And everyone's getting a little trace exposure here and there for what their thyroid requirements are. Now, iodine can be very helpful for things like fibrocystic breast and other things unrelated to the thyroid gland, and it's a very important nutrient. So it's just not like no one should take iodine, because iodine has lots of benefits for many people. It's just that Hashimoto's people have a susceptibility because of the pathophysiology of their disease against TPO, which makes it something that can be a triggering event. So in my practice, I have patients consume foods that are not on the cross-reactive list that have iodine, basically just not supplement with it.
Right. That was my next question. I was going to ask about the foods with iodine, things like seaweed and shrimp. Should Hashi's patients be avoiding these?
The thing is, when we did our molecular mimicry cross-reactivity study, we found many of these food proteins do have cross-reactivity, but just because that's cross-reactivity because of a biochemical structure doesn't mean it's a problem. It's only a problem if you become sensitive to that. So let me give you a great example, seaweed. So seaweed has potential for cross-reactivity, but that doesn't mean you can't eat seaweed, because if you don't make antibodies for the seaweed, there's no reason it's going to attach to your thyroid gland. But some people do have reactivity or sensitivity to seaweed or tuna, which is on the cross-reactive list. So if they consume it and make high amounts of antibodies because they're sensitive to it, it can be a devastating combination. But if you don't have antibodies or immune reactions to seaweed and you consume it, you're getting your iodine source and there's no concern. However, if you have seaweed or tuna antibodies and you ingest it and your antibody counts go up, those antibodies can bind to T3, T4, and then cause your immune system to destroy them.
So just to be optimistic here for people that have Hashimoto's, let's talk about people that come to you, they start following the lifestyle that you've talked about, getting enough sleep, exercising properly, and following the AIP diet with these specific modifications that you've talked about. Is there hope for these patients? Like, what does their prognosis look like?
I'm glad you bring this up. It's not totally hopeless, but as a clinician, you know, you don't want to promise any hope ever, even if you're completely confident that you can make a big difference. I mean, it all depends. If you're trying to promote a book or something, then everything's going to be great and everything's wonderful. But if you're a real practice and you truly are a clinician, you don't go in there with that level of cockiness. You know what I mean? But I don't want to give people no hope, because many Hashimoto's patients completely turn the expression of their autoimmune disease around. I'm just going to say, for me working with patients struggling with it, I can't just go in there and say, yeah, it's great, fantastic. And it kind of sound like a pessimist, but I think it's just what a responsible clinician would do. They would do their best and look for the outcomes. The reality is that we don't know what all the variables are. We don't know why some Hashimoto's patients that change their dietary foods, change their lifestyle, and change their exposure to different infections and things like that respond. We know that a lot of them do. We see a lot of benefits, but it's definitely not hopeless. Like, if you have Hashimoto's, you have a lot of things you can do to change the expression of your disease. And little by little, you can dramatically change how you feel and how you function. But there's no one that completely knows by a single lab mark or by a single symptom who's going to respond and who's not going to respond. Majority of patients do have some type of benefit, and I'm having a hard time answering your question because I don't want to seem like it's hopeless, because it's absolutely not. There's a tremendous amount of potential for people with Hashimoto's to do things to change the expression of autoimmune disease, but at the same time, I can't hype it up just by the instinct of being a clinician, you know?
I get you. And I want to hop into Hashimoto's and vitamin D and the connection there. And you talk about in your book how people with the disease may need additional vitamin D. So let's talk about what's happening there.
So when you look at the research with Hashimoto's, there's a large subset of Hashimoto's patients that have vitamin D receptor polymorphism, which means they genetically can't process vitamin D as effectively as other people. Now, vitamin D is really important for patients with all types of autoimmune disease because vitamin D receptors are found on Treg cells. And if you remember, Treg cells are the main immune cells that calm down the autoimmune response. So we know that a lot of patients that have Hashimoto's have this gene uniqueness. So even if their lab test levels are within normal range with vitamin D, it's not a bad idea to take some supplemental vitamin D. And when you look at lab work for vitamin D, you look at the 25-hydroxy-D levels, they're safe, you know, unless you start to exceed levels above 100. I mean, most people have a really hard time doing that, taking 10,000 IUs of vitamin D, for example. And many Hashimoto's patients are actually deficient and have vitamin D receptor polymorphism with it combined. So vitamin D is critical for them. And there's research also that shows vitamin D helps heal intestinal permeability in addition to supporting Treg cells. So it's a key nutrient patients with Hashimoto's can take. Now, the thing I want to point out, though, is if you have Hashimoto's, what you have to realize is you have an autoimmune disease. Autoimmune diseases, no one has found a cure for them. So it's all really about how you change your lifestyle and the expression of the autoimmune disease. But many people can have fantastic responses with their Hashimoto's once they learn how to modulate it. And many of them can have complete reversal of their labs, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily cured. It means they have to follow that lifestyle to function at their optimum capacity.
So another area I want to get into before we wrap up is the codependency of thyroid and adrenal health and how you need to support one in order to support the other. So I think really addressing the adrenals is really important in this conversation.
When I see, the patients suffering from Hashimoto's, many of them have blood sugar issues, and blood sugar issues spike the autoimmune response. And I talk about this in my book. When you look at patients that are hypothyroid and also have low blood pressure and usually tend to be underweight or normal body weight, they're very athletic. Many times those people, if you look at their adrenal profiles, they have very low cortisol and they have a tendency to be hypoglycemic. And they see some patients have Hashimoto's and they tend to be more overweight and are struggling with prediabetes or insulin resistance. And they usually have like a higher cortisol response or a dysregulated rhythm with their cortisol function. But when your blood sugar levels spike and change, that triggers Th17 responses. So one of the first things we try to do is stabilize their blood sugar levels. The adrenal gland has medulla and a cortex. It produces cortisol, but also produces epinephrine and norepinephrine. And epinephrine and norepinephrine increase the metabolic rate, just like thyroid hormones do. Most patients that have an autoimmune response have some degree of exhaustion of their adrenal glands, and there is a percentage of thyroid patients that actually have antibodies to their adrenal glands as well. They're not going to just respond taking an adrenal cocktail. They're going to have to really calm down their autoimmune disease. Now, there's a lot of theories, and I've seen some of these things between adrenal and thyroid, adrenal. Like, I don't know. Sometimes I see those things and I go, have you really practiced? Like, it's not that simple. All autoimmune patients are going to have some degree of adrenal dysregulation. If you go in there and think you're just going to like support the adrenal glands with some B vitamins and some adrenal tissue and some herbs and see the autoimmune disease calm down is, in my opinion, very clinically naive. You may get a short-term honeymoon phase of feeling better, but ultimately, if you don't calm down the expression of the autoimmune disease, you're not going to see some change. You know, sometimes when you read what people write, you can immediately tell within like 2 seconds they've never practiced. They just have done theoretical thing. Or people that do practice, you know within like 2 minutes they've never done lab work. Because you don't see that some of these philosophical things actually pan out. I mean, I'll put it to you this way. All Hashimoto's patients with lab work, not all, but majority of them are going to have some type of cortisol profile that's off. Occasionally you find then that they're normal and their adrenal profiles look good. But it's part of a web. There isn't one that you would treat first or the other. They're all kind of involved in a cycle. There's an approach where you want to look at diet, lifestyle, and blood sugar management altogether.
We can just maybe expand on this and get into adaptogens. I know you talk about those being really supportive and helpful for people with adrenal dysfunction.
Yeah, I mean, there's adaptogens like Siberian ginseng and Panax ginseng and Rhodiola and ashwagandha. Those things tend to have an effect on just giving people more energy, and they also have an immune modulating effect. It doesn't seem to be immune stimulating, so people can take those to make a difference for them. I just can't stress enough where you have to treat the autoimmunity, and a lot of times the adrenal dysfunction is secondary to the autoimmunity. So once you fix the leaky gut, get them off reactive foods, get a person's immune system not to be so responsive to environmental triggers, you actually see the adrenal glands heal by themselves. And then adaptogens could be a very nice way to give them a little boost on the process of doing that, especially if they need a little bit of help getting their adrenals to function better, to help with their lifestyle to stabilize their blood sugar levels.
And another question I have, which is kind of personal and something that I'm experiencing, and I'm sure some people with Hashimoto's may also be experiencing, and you do talk about this in the book, is swinging between hyperthyroid symptoms and hypothyroid symptoms. I certainly get a little bit of both. What makes this case so unique, or why does this happen? This is something that's been confusing me for a while and had me thinking, oh, maybe I don't have hypothyroidism. Maybe I do have hyper. And then when I found out I had Hashimoto's, that kind of confirmed that. So why the swing? How come this happens?
So it's really common to have both symptoms. So with hypothyroidism, you know, what you tend to get is low metabolic activity and fatigue and constipation. And then with hyperfunction activity, you get like anxiety and restlessness and some insomnia. Most Hashimoto's patients go back and forth because the mechanism of the autoimmune disease is that it attacks the thyroid gland. And when the thyroid gland gets destroyed, those tissues release thyroid hormones in the bloodstream. So you could have a spike of thyroid hormone release and you can get anxiety and inward trembling and palpitations and so forth. Now, if you're getting ups and like if a patient has Hashimoto's and that's happening frequently, that means their autoimmune response is pretty active. I mean, they're getting major flare-ups. So, you know, when you look in the clinical history of a patient with Hashimoto's, if you see that they've had to increase the medication like every year to get their TSH under control, that's letting you know that their autoimmune disease is very aggressive and there's a lot of destruction against the thyroid gland. Compared to a person that comes in and says, I haven't had to increase my thyroid dosage in 5 years, which means their autoimmune disease is kind of stabilized. It's still there, but there hasn't been enough destruction to have their TSH go up and have them increase their thyroid hormones. The same thing with these hyper-hypo responses. If someone comes in and has constantly hyper and hypo flare-up symptoms, then you know that there's this ongoing flare-up with the response. So we teach patients to go, hey, when you get that like anxiety and palpitations and hyper symptoms, think about what triggered it. For some people, it's exposure to a food protein. For other people, it's just stress activated the response. For other people, it's a lifestyle issue. But it's there. And the goal is to really to make sure that when a person has those hyper symptoms like palpitations, nervousness, anxiety, they know that it's very likely that they just had a significant flare-up of their autoimmune response against the thyroid gland, releasing the hormones into their bloodstream.
All right, Tatis, before we let you go, I want to talk about the connection between hypothyroid and digestion. And in the book, you talk about how you like your hypothyroid patients to be supplementing with hydrochloric acid, digestive enzymes, and you also like to support the gallbladder. So I'd just love for you to get into this and share with us why these three different approaches are so important.
From a very fundamental level, thyroid hormones activate areas in the brainstem, the vagomotor nuclei and the nucleus ambiguus. These are what you need to produce digestive enzymes. When people become hypothyroid, they don't get enough activity of these centers autonomically to help their vagus activate enzyme release. And even though the thyroid hormones may be normal, patients that have Hashimoto's, what they found is that the inflammatory response for the autoimmunity decreases what's called signal transduction pathways, which means the receptor site responses are not as effective. So even though they're taking thyroid hormones, they're not getting the same effect on receptors. So many patients that have hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, they end up having decreased vagal activity, which means the gallbladder can't contract as well, they can't produce enough enzymes, and their intestinal motility is compromised, so they get constipated. And because of those, you have to sometimes supplement them with hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes for them to have normal digestive function. That's also critical because you have to change the environment of their gut. I mean, you have to have hydrochloric acid to fight off bacteria and other antigens and pathogens in the body. You have to have hydrochloric acid that digest proteins and break things down so you don't have exaggerated immune responses to food proteins. So it's a vicious cycle, but the majority of Hashimoto's patients do benefit from taking things like hydrochloric acid and supporting their digestion, and many of them have to do it on an ongoing basis.
Okay, I think one other area, I know we keep saying we're going to let you go. We can't let you go yet. I just quickly want to talk about thyroid medication. You do mention in the book that it has no effect on autoimmune disease, but I think there's a lot of people, including myself, who want to know a little bit more about the right approaches and which form or no form, or really, as you said, and I know you've been harping on this throughout the whole conversation, is attacking all the different areas. But how can we just talk about the conversation of thyroid medication and how can people look to either come off or get onto the right one?
Let me clarify a few things. Thyroid hormones do have an effect on the autoimmune disease to some degree. For me, if I have a patient with Hashimoto's, it's essential to make sure that they're medically managed and they're on some type of replacement and follow the standard of care. It's to their benefit. But studies show that when people have Hashimoto's, specifically when they first go on thyroid replacement, their autoimmune system calms down and that there's this regulatory effect of thyroid hormones in a thyroid deficient state. So when they first go on thyroid hormones, they feel a little bit better. And then at some point, the modulating effect is lost and then the immune system kind of does what it needs to do. But the point I've made in the book with thyroid hormone replacement is thyroid hormone replacement doesn't address the pathophysiology or the underlying cause of the autoimmune disease itself. It just addresses the fact that the body can't make it. And it needs to be replaced, and there needs to be a focus on the autoimmune part of it. With thyroid hormones, I mean, there's a level of uniqueness with each patient. You know, as you look at thyroid hormones, there's T4 and there's T3 and there's mixtures of those. And then some people can't handle bioidenticals because all bioidenticals that are prescribed contain T3 and it's too stimulating for them. Some people have to work with the accompanying pharmacist to get a bioidentical T4. Some people can't handle synthetics. Some people don't feel better with one type versus the other. Some people react to the fillers and different thyroid hormones. Some patients feel better when they stop taking the thyroid hormones because they're reacting to fillers. So in Dr. K News, I did write an article explaining all the different adverse reactions and different types of thyroid hormones, and it goes into it in great detail. So I can refer to your listeners to that as well. But at the end of the day, there's some trial and error that each person needs to do. Ultimately, you want to take the dose that has some type of effect, but you wouldn't expect it to get rid of all your thyroid symptoms. You just don't want it to exhaust you and make you feel worse, and you want your labs to be in a normal range. And once that's there, the goal is really to tackle down the autoimmune expression.
All right. Thanks for that breakdown. And we're going to link that article up over at ultimatehealthpodcast.com. So thanks for sharing that. And Datis, we definitely want our listeners to get a copy of your book, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms? But how else can they connect with you after the show?
So everything I do is through Dr. K News, drknews.com. So all my articles and information can be found on that site.
Amazing. And we can't wait for your new book. Is there a timeline on that, or are you just still working on it?
We're still working on it. The goal is to get the first draft done by the end of the year and then start getting it edited. But there's so much research we've done. It's going to be a lot of new information.
We can't wait. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on the show.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode with Datis. There is so much great information, and you definitely have to get yourself a copy of Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms When My Lab Results Are Normal? This is such a comprehensive book for anyone with any kind of thyroid condition, and specifically Hashimoto's. And if you are someone who is suffering from Hashimoto's, not only is it crucial for you to do your own research and learn as much as you can, but you need to ask the right questions. Seek out someone who can help you, and that's why my colleague Samantha Gladish and myself have created Healing and Dealing with Hashimoto's, and this is a way for you to learn and recognize and manage dealing with your symptoms. Also, you're going to learn how to seek out the right practitioners, eat the right foods, take the right supplements, and get support from us directly. We're there to answer your questions. And this program is a 4-week program, and each week we guide you through a different module, and you'll be getting meal plans, recipes, resources, and so much more. So if you want to get some free healing recipes and get on the waiting list, head over to healinghashis.com, get yourself that resource, and get control over your Hashimoto's. I hope that I can help you. This is something that I've been suffering with for over a year now, maybe even longer, but I've known about it for a year, and I've done so much to bring my antibodies down and to feel so much better, and I want to be able to help you. So head over to healinghashis.com, and I hope to see you in our program.
For full show notes, be sure and head over to ultimatehealthpodcast.com/256. We have links there to everything we talked about and a nice show summary. Be sure and check it out. And before we let you guys go, I want to give some love to our editor and engineer, Jay Sanderson, over at podcasttech.com. Jace, thanks for doing such a great job putting the show together. And this week's fun fact about Jace is that he recently went back to the gym after not going for a year, and his body was hurting. Way to go, Jace, getting back in there. Keep at it, and we've all been there. Listeners, have an awesome week. We'll talk soon. Take care.